Thank you for listening to the Just Completed program. If you'd like to offer feedback on any of our programming, please email us at info@wpfw.org.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E.F. Burt Miller. My guest today is Karen Alanier. Karen Alanier is the author of 8 poetry collections. Her most recent book is How We Hold On, published by Broadstone Books. Karen Alanier is the editor of Whose Woods These Are, as well as the editor of From the Belly, Poets Respond to Gertrude Stein's Tender Buttons. Karen Alanier is also the board chair of the WordWorks Publishing Company. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you, Ethelbert?
Well, it's good to see you, okay? You know, we pass and we talk, but I wanted to go back to the 1970s, and that's when my admiration for you begins. You were a member...
As well as mine.
Okay. You were a member of the Folger Shakespeare with a committee down there that was headed up by Obie Hardison, who was at that time was the director of the Folger Library. And what I liked about you... You were the person trying to move this group of well-known poets to do stuff, okay? But they were just wanting to come and have a little sherry in the afternoon. But I want to take it back to that because you were talking about putting pressure on the Washington Post, you know, the literary calendar, talking about the Kennedy Center should be more responsive. But I want to talk about that committee and then also some of the people who are no longer with us, like John Palker, Mae Miller, Obie Hardison himself, Gloria Oden. So take us back to the 1970s.
You know, the thing that I'd been thinking about, Ethelbert, was your talking to me about the importance of being a poet who brings up the issues of the world. So I remember that from our early days and how important that was. And so that has creeped into my work in smaller ways than it has in your work. But I was interested in herding the cats, you know, of the poetry world. And I was working full time, you know, for the government at that point. And, you know, they were going to kick the group out of the Folger. I mean, Jean Nordhaus had done a lot to, you know, keep us informed about what was going on in poetry. And I really didn't want that to go away because I thought it was very useful for us not to be having poetry readings all on the same night, you know. So, you know, that's part of what my drive was about. But, you know, I mean, the WordWorks was built on wanting to promote contemporary poetry and to keep poetry in our culture. You know, it was not like Russia at the time where you could get before an audience of thousands. Didn't work like that here in the United States.
You know, when you talk about WordWork, one name that comes up, because I think it was the founder, was Deirdre Baldwin.
Right.
Talk about Deirdre Baldwin.
Deirdre Baldwin was a rebel rouser.
She sure was.
She caused all kinds of trouble. You know, like we were trying to get nonprofit status. I mean, I wasn't really the we, but, you know, WordWorks was trying to do that. And she was, you know, sabotaging the effort. You know, she really needed to be reined in, but she was a brilliant creative. And, you know, she needed to stay that way. But she had a sort of, you know, desire to shake things up like you, but in a different way. She just shook things up all over the place. Remember that guy, Jim Morissette?
Right.
Oh, my God, you know.
Well, you know what you say about Deirdre. I remember we had a reading out in Virginia. We come back, and I think we stopped at like on P Street near DuPont Circle, and she was so mad, and they didn't pay us, you know, and she used a lot of profanity, you know, she didn't pay us. But you know what, the person that she was close to, and I wish I had spent more time just talking to, was Jean Davis, the artist.
Oh.
She was very close to him, and you know, at that time, you know, I knew the writers, but I didn't really know like the Sam Gilliams and the Lou Stovalls. But you know, I realized that, you know, this was a person that was, every now and then, you know, I would see Deirdre Baldwin, I see him, and I didn't have a realize how important he was, you know, to the visual arts in this area. But if you go back to this I don't want to talk about Wordsworth, but if you go back to the poetry, were there any people that you years now that you really miss? Like I miss Mae Miller, for example.
Oh, yeah. Well, I do miss Robert Sargent. I'm thinking
All
about
right,
Robert
Robert.
because, he was involved with that art community and he used to sit for them as a model, So, I miss him, of course, but, I miss, Hillary Tom, but she came later in our history. Just there were so many people that, we lost. I mean, Betty Perry introduced me to Sterling Brown. I didn't really get a chance to sit with him for too long, but there he was in her house, and we got to talk to him.
Yeah, I remember Betty was the one that could get him out because she had a nice little series over at the Textile Museum.
Yes, that was a really important series, and of course, WordWorks was able to have the documentation for that, The Unicorn in the Garden, which was a beautiful anthology.
Okay. I want to talk also about and have you read a poem because you have a poem in your book on how we hold on that's called Dispatch. And that would have us talk about Jackie Potter.
Yes.
If you could read that and talk about Jacqueline Potter, because she was running the Miller Cabin Poetry Series. And I think that you've established a Jacqueline Potter Young Poets Competition, I think, which is for high school students.
Right. That's true. Okay, let me see if I can.
That's on page 39, I think.
Okay, 39. Yes, indeed. Oh, yeah, I had it marked. Dispatch for Jacqueline. Because I could not hand you a gun nor squeeze the trigger, because I cannot feed you a feast of costly pills, nor can you reach for a bottle at bedside and a razor, a knife is no better than the useless firearm. I tell the caretakers to disconnect the beeping monitors, detach the hanging bags of healing fluids, then I grab hold of your quiet hand and inhale as if breathing for two, and whisper in the labyrinth of your ear, hoping only you will hear, let go, let go.
You're listening to Karen Alanier reading her poem Dispatch from her collection, How We Hold On. Talk about Jacqueline Potter.
Jacqueline was an amazing force. Once she was given a task to do, she went at it full force. And she was amazing. She did the best introductions to the poetry world you ever heard. And she kept them in a notebook. And I still haven't gotten back that notebook from a person who followed her. But it'll come. Jacqueline really loved poetry. And it's what kept her hanging on after she was diagnosed with these terrible brain cysts that kept coming back into her head. And she had a box of pills that was like a war chest. I mean, and if these pills would do her in, there were all kinds of bad things in her war chest of pills. And
Well, when you
occasionally she would
right.
just go unconscious.
Yeah. When you say that, I remember the DuPont Circle, and I think she must have just maybe got test results back or something, and I ran into her and she just collapsed in my arms. She was just crying, she was just dealing with this sense of her health and her life. It was very sad, in terms of at that time, you're just two people. You're not poets anymore, or writers. You're not trying to get, you're just trying to say, okay, how do you be there for a person who's dealing with this sort of clock ticking over themselves? I was just wondering, Karen Alanier, so many writers have dealt with issues like grief. Ed Hirsch was just here. Judith Harris, who lives in the area, she writes about this. How have you handled grief?
Well, you know, poetry is what keeps me alive. So, you know, this book, How We Hold On, is really important to me because, you know, this book is dedicated to, you know, my late husband, Jim Rich. And, you know, he really wanted the poems that I wrote about Jamaica to be published. And, you know, I worked hard with the Larry Moore at Broadstone Books to make this a reality. He didn't like half of what I had in there. I threw it out and, you know, I substituted other sections and he said, yes, that'll work.
Let's look at this. Okay. Because you are an editor also. So how are you dealing with this?
Well, you know, the most important thing was to get these poems about Jamaica published, and he liked those. And so I said, okay, I can work with this, even though he's thrown out the poems that I've written about my grief, you know, in large, you know, relief. He didn't like that part, and neither did other people. And I knew that, and I had told other people that I didn't, you know, you can't just publish a grief manuscript. So I knew that. And I wanted the book published, and I knew that there were good poems in it. So, yeah, that's what you do.
You sound like somebody trying to get a bill through Congress.
Exactly.
Why don't you read for our listeners on The Furniture of Grief? It's on page 19.
All right. The Furniture of Grief. When the only dad I knew died, I shared him with 5 siblings. I rented chairs, short-legged, low to the ground, cold, metal ones. Divorced from him, mother said, no comfort in sitting Shiva. My youngest sister, 20, shifted one foot to the other, tugged the hem of her short skirt, wept that the furniture humiliated the family. A week later, the chairs clattered in the car, spooked my son, whispered, Mom, what's that? Reaching for his small hand, I heard my stepfather's last breaths, how each rattled in his parched throat as he withered in the hospital bed. I heard the drumming rain that pelted the tent as we shoveled earth over the wet wooden box. I heard my stifled cries for the daddy I could not recover, Mom's second, who cushioned me from nightmare falls off tables and cabinets lined up like steps, the man who cradled me while my mother slept through high-pitched screams, it'll be okay.
Karen Ellen there, reading from How We Hold On. You know, when I listened to the two poems you read this morning, it seems that you're almost like bedside watching someone transition. And I'm wondering how difficult that is in terms of some things you can put into words and some things you can't.
You know, I have a ability to be there and to disappear at the same time. So I don't know, it's a some kind of thing that is innate in me. And I can rise to the calamitous occasion when needed. And Jacqueline knew this about me somehow. And she would always call me. She'd be in the hospital and she said, they're releasing me. I have no clothes. Can you go get me clothes?
You know, I wanted to talk to you about something that our listeners might be interested in knowing about. Here we have poems. You were talking about the Jamaican poems. You're talking about poems about grief. Now you're putting a manuscript together before it gets to someone else. How do the poems talk to each other? How do you place the poem? Do you want to begin with a poem, you know, like The Furniture of Grief, as, you know, put that first or second? Is it going to be last? How do you lay out the manuscript?
Yeah, well, you know, you sit on the floor and you start putting things around and seeing what goes with what.
I mean, like an abstract expressionist.
But you know, the interesting thing about this book, it starts with a poem about an experience that I had in Greece.
And Why don't you read that too?
Oh, you want me to read it now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The funny guy and his origins. Baba is a sea captain sleeping opposite corners of his bed. I am a funny guy pressing my face against glass. Mama is a linguist translating what her boy said. Mama cannot sleep with Baba because she's not a trapezoid. How did this funny guy come to be fed? Baba sleeps catty corner even on land to protect his head. Baba lives in fear that his petrol tanker will explode. Can you tell me why this funny guy is seeing red? Greek, German, English. Mama dresses her last word with dread. I am their funny guy. Beachhead. Thoroughbred. Featherbed.
Okay, Karen Helen here. This poem raised a number of questions, and I'm skipping around on some of the things I want to talk to you about. Two, when I hear this poem, you, in terms of you talked about Greece, we know you've been to Morocco. Talk about the importance of travel, geography, and how it affects the overall, sphere of your work, actually.
Well, I think for me, the travel to some of these places gets at who I am. And I'm ancestry.com analyzed, and I'm completely European in one way or another, but you know, half European Jew, and otherwise, you know, German, French, you know, all these different things, Mediterranean in some capacity, maybe less so than I originally thought. But I went to Greece with my late husband's partner in business, and I told my husband, you know, early on that, you know, to have a good life, you have to have younger friends. And so he took that to heart. And so he partnered with this younger woman who then became almost like a daughter to me, like she was a daughter to my husband. And they met in a graduate school program. He went back for a second graduate degree. But, you know, this was one of her cousins, and he died not too long after this poem was written. He had a dangerous life.
Well, you know, you mentioned this travel, and we know that many writers undergo that. But what about the inner journey of Karen Alanier? You know, where are you going on your journey? That's, you know, it's not Greece, it's Morocco. What's happening inside of you?
Well, my inner journey is I'm hoping that I'm building a legacy of something that will last and will be of use to other people. I mean, if there is not that, then what is there?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a good way for us to transition into another topic that when I think of you, I always associate you. And it's sort of, even the poem you just read, I hear a little Gertrude Stein in that poem. But, you know, the playfulness and things of that sort. But let's talk about Gertrude Stein. We associate her with Paris, the avant-garde. We associate her with salons. She was also an art collector. When I look at, you know, read about her life, it seems like maybe there's a connection between her salons and the Cafe Muse that you organize. So just for our listeners who are not familiar with Gertrude Stein, give us a spiel in terms of who she is, and then talk about her influence on your work.
Okay, well, she was an American expat. She went to Paris, lived there most of her adult life. And the interesting thing is that she had cross connections with me because I lived in Baltimore for a little while. She lived in Baltimore, not too far away from where my great grandmother lived. And I lived in my great grandmother's house. She was somebody who was up against the critics all the time and continues to be so. And I feel like, you know, that's my plight as well. So I identify with that. I started reading her autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, which I recommend to people because I think that's the easiest access. It's a fun book. And I started writing poems about the playground and Gertrude Stein back in the late 70s. So this has been a long time effort on my part to understand who she was.
And talk about Toklas, her secretary and lover, you know, talk about her.
Yeah, well, Alice B. Toklas came into her life at the point when she was trying to define herself as a writer. And she teamed up with Alice, who became her editor, who transcribed all of her handwritten manuscripts into typescript. You know, Alice was completely dedicated to Gertrude. And,
Talk about the title, okay? Because it's the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, but it's actually about Gertrude Stein.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it was so outrageous. You know, she always did these outrageous things. I mean, her theater stuff is totally outrageous. It doesn't look like a play at all. It's just always out there. You know, Four Saints in Three Acts. Hmm. And, you know, so anyway, you know.
We'll talk about her connection to, you know, this Matisse, this Picasso, this Hemingway. You know, talk about the people that were surrounding her.
Okay, well, this happened because her brother was collecting art.
That's Leo.
Leo Stein. And he said, well, look, if we pull our money together, we can buy art. And so he started buying, you know, works by Matisse and even Renoir, you know, she was not, I would say, the person who knew so much about art. She had relationships with people, and Picasso was the artist that she had the strongest relationship with. And he did that amazing portrait of her, which is right now in Washington, D.C. at the Portrait Gallery. That never travels. Mm. So, yeah, Brilliant Exiles is the name of the exhibit there. It's really interesting.
Mm. Well, talk about, you know, when I look at your work and you go back, look at Gertrude Stein, I think of Karen Elliner challenging limitations and pursuing new possibilities. Is that what you...
Yes, but I also believe in taking all my friends with me. So, you know, I said, don't go into the Steinian roads alone. Take your friends and family. So, you know, that's how, you know, for example, this is book two of my effort. You
that
know,
just came out too.
Yeah, this is just coming out October 1st. It's in advance review copy. Know anybody who wants to do a review?
Well, let's talk about volume one first. Okay.
Yes, here's volume one with art by Grace Cavallari.
You have Grace Kim there. You got Barbara Goldberg. You got Denise Duhamel. You got Henry Crawford. You got a lot of good people in there.
Right.
Now let's talk about one and then we'll get to two, because you structure this way around Gertrude Stein's work. So you invite poets in, what are they doing?
Okay, so I invited poets to have a segment of the first section of Tender Buttons, which most people, if they've read any Gertrude Stein, have read the first section. And then after that, they stop because they don't know what to do.
What do you mean they don't know what to do?
They don't know what to do. You know, they don't know how to, they think, oh, well, that's just more of the same. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it was more of the same. In volume one, I hear Gertrude Stein, the scientist. In volume two, I hear Gertrude Stein, the lover. And in volume three, I hear Gertrude Stein, the storyteller.
You have very developed ears, Karen Elliner.
I do. I grew up in a household of music. My dad was a drummer in a dance band. I had a brother who was a protege at the piano. I had a sister who like my brother, had perfect pitch, and she played the violin. I had a sister who was, you know, dancing at the British Embassy during pantomime season, you know, and my mother loved music. She loved the piano. She loved, you know, dancing. So, yeah, we listened to the show Name That Tune.
Okay. So let me ask you, with that background, how important is it to listen to Gertrude Stein?
Oh, very. That is key to getting Gertrude Stein, because in the musicality of her work is so important. So it's sort of like, you know, jumping rope. You know, when you're a kid and you jump rope to these nursery rhyme-ish kinds of things, it's like that. It's sort of instinctive.
When you say instinctive, talk about Gertrude Stein and her like spontaneous writing or automatic writing, and also talk about the influence about people like William James on her work.
Okay. Well, William James really was very important to her. And, you know, he told her if she wanted to be a genius, she had to break from habit. You know, so habit is the death toll, you know, for creatives. If you can't break out of, you know, what's ordinary, then you'll never get it.
We need to write a letter to the MacArthur Foundation who gives out those genius awards.
Yeah, but you know, the automatic writing, Gertrude Stein poo-pooed that basically. You know, she didn't think that she was doing automatic writing. She meditated on what she did. She was very clear about what she was, you know, trying to do. So she had something in mind. The problem was that she didn't keep journals that let you in on what she was doing, really.
Well, let me ask you these questions. One, are you keeping journals? Are you doing any sort of spontaneous type of writing?
Every now and again, you know, I write, you know, letters, for example, like, you know, I try to write in somebody else's voice. That may be as, I don't know. I don't really, well, let me go back and say this. Okay. You know, I had a teacher, Rudd Fleming, at the University of Maryland, who said, listen to the music. You know, so he would tap on his desk and he'd say, listen to the music, now write. And so, you know, that's not automatic writing. It comes from somewhere deep within you. And that was, you know, that was the start of how I was really getting to stuff that was worth me putting out there so other people might hear what I was up to.
You know, when I think of Gertrude Stein, and you were talking about Tender Buttons, I'm thinking of Gertrude Stein and I'm thinking of prose poems.
Uh-huh.
If I look at How We Hold On, I don't really see, you know, you're not really in this collection. I was just wondering about how your approach to the prose poem has been over the years.
I believe in those prose poems, and I have a really favorite prose poem in this collection called Girl Talk.
Well, you want to read Girl Talk?
I really love this poem.
And why is it a prose poem and not something else? Is it just for girls?
It's a lot about the talk, you know.
So do you feel that in terms of capturing the talk, you need like a longer line?
I don't know about the longer line, but okay, here's the poem. It's called Girl Talk, and it has an epigraph by Edna St. Vincent Millay, which is, but the rain is full of ghosts tonight that tap and sigh upon the glass and listen for a reply. In the early 60s, my party girl mother, not even a high school graduate, asked her eldest child, she had six, if that would be me, if If she, well, let me start that line over again.
You see, this is prose.
This is asked her eldest child if she had six, if she, that would be me, liked Edna St. Vincent Millay. So, no, I replied, in keeping with the intellectual snobism of the day, tilting my chin to the sky and rolling my eyes. I added, no one likes romantic poetry. But I was a teenager, and my mother, not even two decades ahead of me, who reveled in mistaken identity, making her my slightly older sister, would not be put off. How about Rumi? And why and how she came to ask these questions never occurred to me. Then she had that she had read these authors, had someone else, not likely her husband, dear dad, not the sire of my making, who hid in the upstairs bathroom reading about relativity, he too lacking a high school diploma, who had read these poets, their poems, certainly not my mother with her love of fashion magazines. Still, why was she asking, and did she believe I was a microcosm of her life, a way to know herself, or was this just the best girl talk she could muster with a daughter who read books she did not understand?
Listening to Karen Elanier reading her poem Girl Talk, How We Hold On. We're going to take a little break. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hey, it's that time again. Join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K run walk for total fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details on how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 202-888-5484. That's 202-888-5484. Meet you at the park on Saturday, September 14th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. WPFW, making a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Karen Elanier, who is the author of How We Hold On. Karen, before we took our break, you were reading Girl Talk, and I noticed you sort of stumbled a little bit. For people who don't have the book in front of them, there's no punctuation in this poem. You know, so you really have to get into the girl talk. But talk about what happens in terms when one removes punctuation from a poem.
Well, this came about after my late husband passed, because I wanted more fluidity in the work. I wanted things to flow without stopping. And I thought that was the way to really be heard.
Well, talking about being heard, and we were talking about music, you know, in the other part of our show. Talk about your interest in opera. When did that begin, and the things that you're doing in that genre?
You know, it was a strange thing that happened. I was told many years ago by a psychic that my work would be on stage in New York. I had no idea. In 1981, I sat with Paul Bowles in Morocco. And he helped me work out some of the rhythms in my poem, Leo on Seesaw. And I had no idea that I would put that into an opera, that my poems about Stein would become the opera, Gertrude Stein Invents a Jump early on. My sister, who played the violin, said that I should be thinking about setting my words to music. She said that was important. And so, you know, it was a confluence of things. You know, I had people read a short play that I wrote that preceded the opera libretto. You know, people like Kim Roberts came to help, you know, Hillary Tom, Jacqueline Potter, Miles David Moore. All kinds of people came to help read. There were 12 voices in that play. And so that was the beginning of it.
How difficult is it to write a libretto? I mean, I think of people I've known who have tackled that. One is Thelonie Davis, who did the X opera. The other was actually Dolores Kendrick, who was our poet laureate here in D.C. after Sterling Brown. Talk about the challenge of writing a libretto. I mean, it's a specific form, you're writing it for several people. I mean, how do you handle that?
Well, this is an interesting question because I'm working on a second opera about the love life of Jane and Paul Bowles. And so I had a libretto based on poetry that I had written about them, you know, in separate poems. And I finally came to this friend of mine who I met swing dancing. She was into opera. And I said, Janet, I think it's time for us to collaborate, you know, on this opera. And she says, okay, only on one condition. You have to write a new libretto. And here's how I want it done. And I said, okay, I can do that.
Well, you know, you've mentioned Paul Bowles' name a couple of times. You have a book, The Enigma of Paul Bowles. Talk about Paul Bowles. I mean, he wrote The Sheltering Sky in 1949. He actually died in 1999. Talk about, you know, you definitely were influenced by this individual. And talk about how you got to Morocco. Was he the reason why you went to Morocco? And just talk about the relationship.
Okay, so I had taken a trip in 1980 to Morocco, and a woman who was doing typesetting for us said, oh, look at this. There's an ad here for working with Paul Bowles. You should go and do this. And I thought to myself, really? Okay. I applied for it. It was, you know, through the School of Visual Arts in New York. And I sent them 50 pages of a novel that I had started. And, you know, I was accepted for the program and I decided, okay, well, I'm going. So that's how that came about. And, you know, I read everything that I could read by Bowles, and I brought with me his book of poetry that was released by, what's the name? Sparrow, you know?
Like Black Sparrow?
Yeah. And he says, oh, he apologized for it. He said, Gertrude Stein said my poetry was bad. And I said, well, I think it's good. She just didn't like your negativity, your blackness, your darkness.
You told him.
I did. Because I believed his poetry was quite good. It just that wasn't to her taste.
Mm. When you think about Paul Bowles, and it has a lot to do with how we remember writers, how should we remember his work?
It is very dark. It's existential. It's in the French camp. You know, that's how I would think of it. It's scary in lots of ways.
Okay, well, we won't scare our listeners today. Let's hear a poem, which is, I'll use it as an example, because many times when writers are walking around, they see things and they can document it. You have a poem called Against the Wall, which I want you to read, which is about the Marilyn Monroe mural that's there on Connecticut Avenue. If you can read that.
Okay. Against the Wall. For Norma Jean, Marilyn, Orr. At Calvert and Connecticut, she watches. All I remember is her face, larger than a window flung open in spring, that face floating above brick, mortar, and cement. Her bleached hair expands the white of her eyes, eyes that steal light from the passers-by. Rumor says she shared lipstick with my mother as they strolled arm in arm down a runway lined with impatient men, each holding out his will. At Calvert and Connecticut, she beckons. "What will you do?" she whispers with petulant lips. "Mom," I shout from a cafe where, drinking wine with a friend, I glimpse the beauty pageant of pliant skin and curving body receding down the avenue with a playful skip. She remains a child, that child Arthur Miller says, whose spirit we cannot chase, best to rest in place and let her return with love. At Calvert and Connecticut, I'll see her there, up against the wall.
Karen Aldenier. Karen, let's look at this poem closely. I was wondering, how many times did you perhaps walk or drive past this mural and didn't think about it? And then when did you begin to write a poem about it?
Gosh. You know, I'm not sure how the poem actually came about. It must have come about because of being on Connecticut Avenue when I was sitting with a friend and seeing that poem, that poster. Well, it's a fresco.
Yeah,
it's a mural. And so this poem was picked up by Kim Roberts in her anthology that is what is something Moonlight on K Street.
Oh, right, about the DC area, right?
Yeah, on the DC area, and then it was it was set to music. You know, I took a tango.
Took a tango,
and you know that had wonderful mysterious riffs going on in it.
Well, let's look at this on a number of levels. There's definitely parts of this poem which is personal,
mm-hmm.
okay? And then it's also, I would say, it's a poem that has some little research because you're making reference to Arthur Miller. So I'm looking at that. And then I guess the bigger question is, you as a woman, you're not blonde, but I just wonder how you see, you know, Marilyn Monroe defining womanhood actually for a period of time.
Well, you know, Marilyn Monroe was somebody that was held up, you know, in my mother's generation, really. My mother, who wasn't all that, you know, much older than me, really. She was 19 when she had me. I had this friend who was a starlet in Hollywood with Marilyn Monroe. She just turned 100 this year. And, you know, I think she was somebody that I had in mind when I was, you know, writing about this poem. Hmm. You know, so Marilyn Monroe was not somebody that I strive to be. I wasn't interested in being like her. My mother was, you know, kind of a beauty queen, and she loved, you know, fine clothes, and she was good at making them. She was good at, you know, deciding what to wear, you know, that kind of thing.
That's interesting, because, you know, what happens is that if we were giving out assignments and say, okay, pick some place in the city and, you know, walk and write a poem about it. But you can see that what you do in this poem, it's personal. You know, this, you're not just looking at it. There's a lot of things happening before this poem is produced. Yeah. Let's look at another poem, which is in another collection. And I want to ask you about this poem, Race, which is in your collection, Looking for Divine Transportation. And this is a Bunny and the Crocodile Press book. This is a Grace Cavalieri book.
Yes.
Okay. Talk about the poem Race that's on page 75.
Okay.
And it's about Billie Holiday. So we go from Marilyn Monroe to Billie Holiday. And I'm assuming it's a Billie Holiday because of this Baltimore connection that you were mentioning early in our show.
Okay, here we go. Race. We're traveling south in America, Billy and me. She's singing out her heart, practicing. I'm driving, alert to the highway patrol, vigilantes, road rudeness, people who cut you off, drive on your tail, scare you white as if a vampire had sunk his fangs. Not like the old days. Billy shakes her head. I say, reading the signs, but exceeding the limit. On a bridge ahead, a freight train pulls its load. I reach back, pat my stuff to make sure it's there. No doubt we've got our baggage. Neither of us travels light. To the west, a lake defines its banks as we speed past. How could she do it? Billy moans, and from that vibrato comes. Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood at the leaves and blood at the root. She just strapped them in, released the brake, let the car roll into the muddy lake. Black body swinging. Said a black man, hijacked the car, kidnapped the children. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. It's a pileup on the interstate, blamed on dense fog. We get out to gape, unable to render aid, only to mire the traffic more. The news throbs inside. We hear the story repeat. Billy says we've got to go. The gig won't wait.
You're listening to Karen Alanier reading from her book, Looking for Divine Transportation. Karen, I want to ask you the question that many people have been wrestling with, you know, and that's how do we as American writers deal with issues of race? And I was wondering, how have you wrestled with the issue of race in your own career?
Yeah, well, you know, I come from a Jewish background, so there is an issue of race for me as well. And, you know, in this poem, you know, Billy is a spirit in my car. She's coming through the radio, really. But also, I'm thinking about this trip that I took as a college student with a couple of other college kids. And we were driving from, you know, this area, DC, down to Florida. And I was shocked. I had never been through that, through the South. There were billboards with Ku Klux Klan rising up at night, you know, on horses in their hoods. And we got stopped by a Georgia cop who was a stereotype of what you expect a Georgia cop to look like. He was, you know, a fat man with a heavy Southern accent. And I guess we were speeding, but the guy who was driving managed to talk him out of giving him a ticket. You know, it was, you know, we were going actually to a music festival on top of that. That was like one of the early, you know, rock festivals preceding, you know, all the famous ones like Woodstock and all that kind of stuff. Anyway. So part of that comes into this poem. And, you know, of course, this was written at the time of the Susan Smith incident. And, you know, it was like I couldn't believe that a mother would do this to her children.
And then, you know, people were saying they saw the black man. It was all, I mean, a person who writes about this well is Cornelius Eady.
Right.
Yeah, right. He's
yeah. And I have a history with Cornelius, actually.
Talk about that.
Yeah, he came in red at the Miller Cabin, you know, years ago, and we were both published by a dance publisher. You know, he had his book about dance stuff, and I had my poems, you know, The Dancer's Muse, mm-hmm. You know, so we had a history together, you know, way back.
Yeah, that's always, he always reminds me. I think I gave him his first reading when he was like working up in New Jersey somewhere, and I must have paid him $35 or something like that. But it was his first paid reading, and he was so grateful, you know. But I really love him in terms of that. I want to ask you some questions. We come to the end of the show, Karen Ellen, there are questions that I think you're in a good position to answer, and that is to look at your career in terms of, we were talking about the 70s and all the people that we knew. Where are things today? You know, if you were a young writer, you know, in California, where you want to relocate to Washington, D.C., I mean, what are the resources here? Is this a wonderful time to be a poet?
I think it's always a wonderful time to be a poet. I think, you know, this seems to be less of a drive to expand poetry for everybody, you know, in the younger generation. There seems to be less concentration. People don't have the passion, you know, to read other people's poetry. I always think of Holly Bass when I think about that, because she always was reading other people's poetry out loud, and then she would read her own.
That was something that Dana Joy also encouraged when he was heading up the NEA Literature Division.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, one point for him. Yeah. So yeah. But I think, you know, the younger poets these days, they need to find their passion. That's what I think. They need to find their passion. You know, I want WordWorks to continue into the future, but that's not an easy thing to do. You know,
Let's look at that. I mean, we're talking poetry. We know that a lot of people, young people, are doing spoken word. You have the Jacqueline Potter Young Poets Competition, you know, for high school students. I mean, is that poets who are writing on a page, or is that people who are also participating in terms of, you know, the oral tradition?
Yeah, well, we have published some people who are from the oral tradition. And in fact, we even published a book on the spoken word that actually Kim Roberts, you know, did the research for. And we published her pamphlet basically on that. But we have some, you know, we have some people that are in that tradition. You know, actually, Donna Denise, we published way back, you know, Broken Like Job. She was really from the oral tradition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's harder to get that on the page and have it work well. Right. And so, but we worked with her, and it's a good book, a good solid book.
Well, you know, we talk about this, and this is one of the things I admire about you. You know, running and keeping a publishing company, you know, for a period of years, you know, is very difficult. And when I think about this area, you know, I'm thinking about you, Grace Cavalieri, Merle Leffler, but it does take its toll. And I was also looking at, for example, in this collection, looking for Divine Transportation, it says here that there's the reference to the WordWorks distribution. And so I was just wondering, in terms of how you're handling as a company distribution, because that's always a key for small presses.
Yeah, ever since, you know, the small press distribution went under.
Exactly.
We're going through, you know, Amazon, basically, you know, because we don't really want to be in the business of just sending out books. We do a little bit of that. But, mm-hmm. you know, Nancy White, who I had a conversation with, you know, back before 2009, she wanted to start her own press. I said, wait a minute, this is your press. You know, you were published by the WordWorks. You know, you are a Washington Prize winner. You can be president.
All right. We end on that note. Okay. Today, my guest has been Karen Ellenier. I really have admiration for her. She is the author of 8 poetry collections. Her most recent book, which you were listening to and read from, is How We Hold On, published by Broadstone Books. Also, very important, is From the Belly, Poets Respond to Gertrude Stein, Tender Buttons. And what's the new one that's out?
The new one is out, Tender Buttons Food.
All right. Okay. And I think there's some interesting people in there. I think Margie Perloff is in there. Abdul Ali's in that collection, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Well, she's only, they are both blurb, you know, blurb.
Oh, they're about the blurbs. Okay. Like yeah. Oprah. Okay. All right. Well, Karen, thank you very much for being my guest on The Margin. The show's On The Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hey, it's that time again. Join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K run walk for total fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details and how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 202-888-5484. That's 202-888-5484. Meet you at the park on Saturday, September 14th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. WPFW, making a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Are you passionate about eradicating air pollution? Would you like to participate in the Environmental Justice Artivist Fellows Transformative Community Art Project in Ward 5, Washington, D.C.? We're seeking Ward 5 professional and amateur photographer portraits that capture the theme of what clean air in Ward 5 should be. Selected submissions will be featured in the Up in the Air mural design, which will be installed in a prominent Ward 5 location in fall 2024. Submission is free. The deadline is next Saturday, September 14th. Submissions can be made at socialartandculture.info.
Code Pink, Women for Peace, is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words, Beats, and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults, with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy.
All right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
Peace, everyone. I'm Brother Jamil, and in the Yardbird Suites tradition established by our dear brother Askia Muhammad, we continue every Tuesday morning from 5 to 8, playing some things you've never heard before and also playing some old favorites. But we invite you to join us each and every Tuesday as we have an audio family reunion right here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington. Peace.
Bethesda Theater presents the SOS Band on Friday and Saturday, September 20th and 21st. Spiral.